Hello, I'm Christopher Badger.
And I'm Mark Davis.
We're barristers at Six Pump Court and would like to welcome you to the latest Environmental Law News podcast, brought to you in association with LexisNexis. In this podcast, we look at the development of the draft Environment Principles and Governance Bill, recent authorities on abusive process in a regulatory context, and whether an invasion of privacy can amount to nuisance. First, we look at the continuing scrutiny of the draft Environment Principles and Governance Bill.
Yes, the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Committee continues its pre-legislative scrutiny of the draft bill. It has published the written responses received and continues to hear oral evidence.
On the 6th of March this year, it was the turn of Michael Gove, Therese Coffey and David Menotti to give evidence. It was emphasised that the Office for Environmental Protection should be properly resourced, so that it can have at its command a battery of experts and legal staff and opinions.
Well, that sounds eminently sensible. What were the other key issues? Well,
firstly, the committee raised the key question on whether the OEP would be properly funded and whether it needed more independence in its funding.
Now, this of course highlights concerns that have been raised by many participants that the OEP is too dependent on DEFRA and the Secretary of State.
Yes. Well, Therese Coffey responded that the OEP will be able to make a statement, essentially on whether they have enough money or not, which will no doubt be seriously considered. It was also emphasised that the OEP is not undertaking to be a delivery partner for the government, but is very much about scrutinising government. Michael Gove was more non-committal, responding that any suggestions would be gratefully received and looked at with generosity.
But is it not constitutionally challenging for Parliament to have an OEP that is directly accountable to it, like the National Audit Office, but which could also take the government to court? I mean, it's a novel concept to have a national body that is able to enforce against the government.
Yes, but that shouldn't necessarily be any form of bar. But Michael Gove's response was that it was government's intention to make sure they had the most stable constitutional footing. And yet there is real concern from legal experts, that the body does not necessarily need to be an arm's length body of DEFRA. If it was split from DEFRA, it would be more independent and potentially more powerful as a result.
Yes, I don't get the impression that Michael Gove particularly agreed with that proposition.
Indeed not. When asked directly, "Are you convinced that this new OEP will be independent and strong enough, not just to take DEFRA on, but take on the whole of government?" The response of both Therese Coffey and Michael Gove was a resounding yes, in contrast to almost all of the evidence that's been received by the committee. David Menotti sought to support his minister by emphasising that the Secretary of State does not have the power to direct the board of the OEP in any way.
Well, we all know Mr. Gove's thoughts on experts, but what were the other main concerns?
Reference was made to the power of the OEP to challenge the Environment Agency on its application of the law. And Therese Coffey did not think that it would be right for the OEP to be able to legally override the decisions of the Environment Agency by issuing a legally binding notice.
And was judicial review mentioned in that context?
Well, Michael Gove's response to criticisms that have been made of the reliance on judicial review to resolve disputes was to state that the government had sought to replicate what he considered to be an easily understandable process as far as possible. He didn't rise to the suggestion that there should be an expanded role for the Environmental Tribunal, although he didn't rule it out. Therese Coffey's response was that the process that the CJEU undertakes is similar to, in effect, the same as, the JR process.
But can that be right?
Well, no. Professor McCrory has already highlighted the difference in approach between traditional judicial review and the application of Wednesbury unreasonableness, and the European Court's approach of adopting a proportionality test involving a more structured examination of the balancing interest involved. The concern is that reliance on judicial review will not bring the same degree of review as currently adopted by the European Court in infringement proceedings.
But are we not being diverted by unnecessary issues surrounding an enforcement process? I mean, is it not the case that the OEP is supposed to be a group that will not need organisations to constantly think that the only way to go is to the High Court to have a discussion on environmental law?
But the OEP's advisory role is specifically on whether measures the government are taking are in line with the improvement plan that is required in the draft bill. Are you on track is the key question, considering the goals of the 25-year plan. But there's real concern that nothing will actually be achieved. And the committee cited the fact that, since Michael Gove took over as Secretary of State, there have been 77 consultations, but just one piece of primary legislation, and 45 of those consultations has not resulted in any action whatsoever.
Well, that's fairly shocking. But what about the inherent weakness in the fact that government need only have regard to the environmental principles?
Well, Michael Gove didn't accept that the provision on environmental principles was too weak, despite the plethora of evidence to this effect. His response was that the words "have regard to" were thought to be the closest in terms of achieving the same legal effect as European provisions. Michael Gove fell back on the fact that it is a well understood phrase.
But yet again, doesn't that rather miss the point here? I mean, it's very easy to have regard to something without according it much weight.
Well, the committee was certainly of the view that the wording was weak, but the repeated approach of the Secretary of State was to insist that he was open-minded, not ruling anything out, but at the same time refusing to accept that criticisms that had been made of the current draft were valid and would result in improvements. The recommendations of the committee will prove very interesting indeed, but whether they will be taken up is another matter entirely.
Well, I guess we'll just have to keep our fingers crossed. Right. Second, we turn our eyes to the possible revival of abusive process.
Recent judgments from the Court of Appeal show that judges at first instance in the criminal courts are prepared to be outraged by the regulatory behaviour of local authorities. In the context of settlement negotiations about enforcement notices, individual courts have recently stayed criminal proceedings that have been brought after defendants have been led to believe that a compromise might be reached, leading to an alteration of their position to their detriment.
Absolutely. And the cases are R and the Knightland Foundation, Ceredon County Councillor Robinson, and Wokingham Borough Councillor Scott and others. The last of the three is a particularly useful read, and I would really recommend it. Much more can be derived from reading it than can be adequately set out in any short commentary. It is worth noting that the judges at first instance were supported in each case. And in Wokingham's case, the chief defendant withdrew his appeal against an enforcement notice based on representations made by the council that they would come to a mutually satisfactory agreement.
Yes, whilst in the Knightland Foundation's case, enforcement officers interfered with the planning application process, so that the defendant was denied his legitimate expectation that it would be determined on its merits. A similar finding about legitimate expectation also being made in Wokingham Borough Council's case. In both, the local authorities' desire to take advantage of the poker regime played a part.
Indeed, and the Court of Appeal in the Wokingham case dismissed the suggestion that a solemn promise not to prosecute is always required to support an abuse argument, and various authorities were considered. And in fact, the court was somewhat critical of the Blackstone's commentary on this issue.
Ultimately, the tribunal at first instance must assess all the circumstances. Practitioners will find the underlying notion of an inducement to a defendant in the context of the detailed guidance in the Code for Crown Prosecutors to be a fertile area. But it is clear that judges will be affronted where they think a settlement has resulted in some detriment to the defendant, especially if it is likely that a regulator has an eye to some financial advantage from poker. There is a clear thread that the criminal courts are worried about poker and the influence that the ability of the prosecutor to profit from the prosecution can have on a decision to prosecute. Moreover, judges in the Court of Appeal have perhaps become less likely to intervene than they once were.
And these are planning cases, but the principles must be understood as applying to all environmental and other regulators. Lady Justice Hallett's rejection of a possible chilling effect on negotiations at the end of the Wokingham case judgment is telling. That is indeed a probable result and an unfortunate unintended consequence.
Our final story concerns the wonderful view of the neighbouring flats to the Tate Modern.
Yes, I went to the new Tate Modern Viewing Gallery the other day.
Lovely.
Indeed it is, and on the 10th floor of the new extension, you can enjoy a quite spectacular 360-degree panoramic view of London. It's essentially a new permanent exhibition.
Sounds great.
Indeed it is. But as part of it, you also get a good view of the interiors of the neighbouring Neo Bankside development, which is a development of flats that is extensively glassed.
Hang on a minute. Wasn't that the subject of a recent High Court nuisance case?
Well, yes it was. Certain residents in the new development brought an action against the Tate Modern, claiming that their privacy had been invaded by the new viewing gallery. The residents complained that visitors to the Tate had watched, photographed, filmed, waved, and even, on occasion, used binoculars to look into their flats.
Sounds like an invasion of privacy to me.
Well, as a matter of principle, an invasion of privacy can amount to a nuisance. The weakness of the claimant's case was that the flat's design and their way of living in them had created a sensitivity to privacy that was greater than would have been the case in a less glass-fronted flat. Other architectural designs would have reduced the invasion of privacy to levels which should be tolerated. And the court considered the concept of oversensitivity as relevant to the give and take between neighbours in different locations.
Any good quotes?
Absolutely. My favourite is, "What can reasonably be expected by way of protection from view in an isolated cottage in rural Dorset will be very different from that which can reasonably be expected in a curtainless window by a bus stop or an uncurtained glass box in a congested sky." Excellent.
Thank you for tuning in for this Environmental Law News podcast. For more information on any of these stories, or if you would like to discuss any of the topics raised in more detail, please contact Six Pump Court on 0207 797 8400, asking for either Christopher Badger or Mark Davies, or contact our colleagues at LexisNexis in the PSL Environment team.